Well, good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to start this morning with a reflection with music and sound and words, so that whatever modality speaks to you, just music, sound, perhaps it's words, perhaps from the words come images. And we're going to start our prayer that way because I think as we come to this topic of imaging life after life or life after death, however you come to understand it, we use all of that, all our senses, all our awareness, all the things that live within us, that move us to understanding. So I'm going to just get us in that by, if you take a moment to make sure your feet are squarely on the floor, and if you stand about hip width apart, I'm mindful that for some of us, closing our eyes is not a comfortable thing, but if it is for you, go inside and just for a minute follow your breath, making the inhalation long and deep, all the way down to your belly. Exhaling completely, so that there's really a free flow of your breath, your nourishing breath, your ruha, spirit, chi, prana, however you understand that, nourishing your entire body. And with the breath, we come to attention and awareness. We let go of what has happened this morning before we came. We let go of what will be this afternoon. So that with the breath and with an awareness of the present moment, we can take in everything. Open your eyes. Take a moment, if you can, to image yourself completely surrounded by the love of God. Before you, behind you, within you, above you, below you. A love that sustains you and protects you every moment of every day. Incredible CD called The Pilgrim. We actually use that piece as an opening prayer in the bereavement program for the Archdiocese. And I never listen to it without a very emotional response. For me, it is very related to the material of this book. How do we image ourselves? How do we image God? What is the soul? All the questions that we're going to come to today. And a few more that Kathleen didn't think of that I'm going to add. But before we begin, I really want to thank Alice for this opportunity. This is not a topic that we spend a great deal of our day thinking about, is it? It may come in the ebb and flow of caring for loved ones or a loss, but to really go deep with it, and I have to admit, even in my years in hospital chaplaincy, being with death and dying on a daily basis, to think about it theologically, to be willing to wrestle with questions, is not usually something you do when you're in the trenches on a day-to-day basis. So this has been several months for me of reflection, and I shared with Alice, as I'm sure happens with all of you, when you dive into a subject, it comes after you, too. And the last 2 weeks, I've had some incredible encounters with people and stories that found me in the midst of this. So thank you, Alice. I'm very grateful. I'm also grateful to Anita, although she's not wearing her butterflies today. So your talk last week was wonderful. And it was... And you're a hard act to follow, hometown girl, that whole thing. But one of the key things for me that you used and did so well is the use of stories. And we can take facts and we can look at theology and we can understand science, but where the rubber meets the road is just the human experience and the story. So you did that very beautifully. And I'm very, very grateful for not to follow you, but for your sharing. Well, I also want to take a moment, and I'll be unabashedly forward about this, to just share something that I'm involved with that I think all of you should know about. And that's the Wellness Center at the Cancer Center of Santa Barbara. Have any of you taken advantage of their programs or know someone who has? Great. I think this is one of the best-kept silent resources in our community. People tend to seem to find out about it only when they are needing it. And I want to say that wellness programs at the Cancer Center of Santa Barbara are open and available to everyone in this community. You do not need to be a patient of the Cancer Center or their physicians. You can be getting treatment outside the community. You can have a loved one who's getting treatment outside the community. It's an incredible resource. The classes consist of yoga and qigong and music and art. There's a laughter class that's conducted in collaboration with Hospice of Santa Barbara. Perry Longo, who is our poet laureate here in Santa Barbara, does a poetry class, again, in collaboration with the Hospice of Santa Barbara. I'm involved in doing Healing Touch there, and I have a colleague as well, Noemi Laretta, who on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, we're available for sessions for caregivers as well as family members. So, being bold, I took the liberty of bringing flyers about the Healing Touch program, and I trust there's one for everyone. And I'm, yes?
Do you have to have cancer?
You need to be a person who is a survivor or is in treatment or a caregiver of someone. So that is the restriction. There are all sorts of things that open up to you in the world when you have cancer, and this is one of those wonderful things. The other part of the Cancer Center of Santa Barbara that is part of the wellness offerings, and I think is incredible, is the resource library. If you need any information about treatment, protocols, types of cancer, they even now have CDs on meditation and prayer and focusing that people can check out. It's a wonderful, wonderful resource. So I just thank you. And I just wanted to be bold today and make sure you're aware. I know what tends to happen in my life, that something becomes important when I need it. But this is something I hope you'll just plant that seed and think about it. Cancer visits all of us in one way or another. And this is a wonderful place to begin a journey of healing. One of the things I love about the Cancer Center, too, is they have two different entrances. There's an entrance for treatment, and there's an entrance for wellness. And to me, they're both under one roof. But the idea is when you come from illness, that's your focus, and healing is your focus. So plant some seeds. I always like to do that, and I hope we'll see you there. Well, as I said, Anita did such a beautiful job with stories, and I think stories are where we know, we encounter truth. And so I wanted to start with a story. And this experience came to me just in my preparation over the last 2 weeks. I was asked to speak at a parent support group of parents with children with cancer. And that's a pretty powerful thing. My children did not have cancer. And I can be compassionate and empathize, but I knew these parents had more to teach me than I had to teach them. But I was asked to speak about integrative therapies, and this is a whole topic and part of my life now. Very, very important. How do we bring to bear many other resources in our healing process, not as an alternative, but as a complementary or integrative journey? And one of the things, in addition to acupressure, acupuncture, massage, healing touch, all the wonderful resources that people can use, I always put on my list prayer and meditation. And it's interesting to me, more and more, as I work with groups around the issues of healing, that they zone in on that one. It's like in other venues, they haven't had a chance to really talk about that. And I go into a group, I don't know what their faith tradition is, I don't know what their faith experience is, but when you put down prayer and meditation, you get people talking. And when I ask the group what experience did they have with integrative therapies, most of the people in the group said, well, it's prayer and meditation that I really use. And one of the mothers, I said, could you tell me more about that? What is that like for you? And she said, well, I pray to St. Philomena. And I said, well, could you say more about that? She said when her son, who is now 4, and he was 1 at the time when he was diagnosed with leukemia, she said, I knew we were going to have a long journey. And actually, the night I met her was the night before his last chemotherapy, and he'd been in treatment for 3 years. A lot of these families, especially with childhood leukemia, it lasts over a period of time. She said, as soon as I found out the diagnosis, I knew I needed someone to pray to. And she said, I've kind of been in and out of the church, but I knew I needed to find the right saint. And she went on the internet, she talked to her priest, she surveyed neighbors, and Philomena came to her. She said, I knew that was the right saint for me, and I found the novena that I pray every night, and I have prayed every night since he was diagnosed. In addition, she said, he wears a medal, and she got her little boy, and she goes, show her your medal. And he had on a medal of Philomena with a medal that just had his name on it. He was very proud of those. Then she said, you know, in his bedroom, we have a statue of Philomena. And it wasn't a statue. She said, we have a statue of Philomena. And, she said, with great joy and enthusiasm, not as someone who isn't real about the risks and challenges of disease and what can happen, but she said, when he's 16, we're going to Rome. And we're going to Rome because the relics of St. Philomena are 30 miles north of Rome in a village called Mugnango. I think I have that right. And we're going to go there because I know by then he'll be old enough to remember it all his life. Mm-hmm. Later, the social worker emailed me and said, you know, thank you for your help with the group. And she said, you know, I've known that family for 2 years, and I didn't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. One of my things, advocacy, is if faith and prayer are issues for you in your healing process, let everybody know. Let your doctor know. Let your social worker know. Well, I took the liberty, since I did not know Philomena well, of downloading a few pictures of her. I won't go into her hagiography, but it's quite an interesting story. And although she was taken off the yearly prayer list for saints in 1961 before Vatican II, I don't think this mother knew that. I don't think it really matters. And you'll see several images of Philomena, but I think one of the most interesting, and when we talk about images of God, which I think this little boy is going to be fed by having a statue in his room, in his home growing up, she carries arrows, she was martyred, and flowers. Interesting contrast. So I'll just pass that around. Several different visions of Philomena. Well, I think this story for me connected very deeply with the first preface and the first two chapters of Kathleen Fisher's book. I bring to that story a series of questions. What image does this child, or will this child, have of God, not only in the present moment, but for all his life? And how will he think of the divine? Now, I don't have an answer for that, and I don't expect you to, but it would be interesting to go back in 25 or 30 years and ask him about that. How will he know himself to be loved, and by whom, and how? How has his mother's image of God grown and changed in the experience? And with her images of God present in the midst of suffering and healing, so Philomena was there for her in suffering and healing, what might be this mother's image of life after death, or life after life? What might be her son's image of what happens when we die? I sense that St. Philomena is going to play a very important role for that family in how they image the divine, how they image God. And it will be a strongly feminine image of the divine. Well, Kathleen Fisher is a woman who is very comfortable with questions, and so am I. So I was not surprised in just reading the preface of the book to see that she already was posing questions. And I think those three questions at the very second paragraph of the book begin to stimulate us about what the direction she is going. And I think they're the questions that engage us throughout the text, but I will specifically talk about these first two chapters. Her first question in the preface is, what survives death? What survives when we die? Do relationships continue beyond death? And the third question, how does life now relate to life then? That's why I like to talk about life after life. And she poses that right here. How does life now relate to life then? And in those first two chapters, she takes these questions up in some very specific ways. And she poses for us the possibility of pondering the role of several things as we address these questions. The first is new discoveries in science. Now, I'm not going to talk a lot about that today because I'm not a scientist, and quantum physics amazes me. But she brings to bear the new sciences, the integration of new ways of thinking about, and I'll allude to a couple of those that are very powerful. She talks about scripture as a way to ponder these questions. Poetry as a way in to these questions. Good literature, and I think I would put in that fiction as well as nonfiction, autobiographies, biographies as well. Story, like Anita. We tell stories, we listen to stories. We don't tend to do that much in our culture anymore. We don't sit around the campfire. But our stories are very relevant, and they reveal our lived experience, which is very much connected to our image of God. Prayer, and in all its forms. And I would add to her list And I'm sure many of you would add other things too. Music and creation as ways for us to begin our conversation around those three critical questions for the whole book. Now, Kathleen, and I'm going to call her Kathleen. I haven't met her. I've read several of her books, but I'm going to use her first name. She indicates that images of the afterlife are familiar to us in the Christian tradition, and she suggests in her preface that she will use four. They are seeds, something we know a lot about in our scriptures, butterflies, and she's got a whole chapter about that, fire and light. So those are going to be images that she's going to hone in on, and because she is, I'm going to find a few others for us to consider today. And she suggests in that preface that, and I think this is very important, the heart of the exploration of these questions is in the midst of ordinary human persons. It's not relegated to theologians or philosophers or great thinkers, or it's in the heart of our ordinary and daily experience. And I think it's critical for you to adapt or accept that notion to proceed with the book. It validates your experience, and she's saying that's just as important as anything else I'm going to tell you. Engagement with genuine experience. Well, after reading that preface and those first two chapters, I came up with three questions for today that I think really get to the heart of this material and take into account this notion of ordinary people reflecting on meaningful and life-changing questions. The first question I would ask is, what is your image of God? Right now, today, if you were bold enough to stand up in this group and share, what would that be for you? And I would pose that that's not a stagnant thing. It's an ever-changing thing. It's an evolving and growing thing. But what is your image of God? Second, what is the soul? Do you have one?
What is
one? The soul.
Oh.
What have you thought about that? What's your experience of that? Is there a difference between the body and the soul for you? Okay? And lastly, how I want to bring these two together is, how does your image of God and your understanding of the nature of the soul shape your image of life after life or life after death? And I would suggest that we can take our understanding or image of God, we can take our understanding of the soul and use those as a way in to what life after death may be. So, how do you get there? How do you connect with your own story? And one way sometimes is to hear a story. So I want to read a little section of a wonderful story and then pose a question to you. This book is fabulous if you love story. It's called Story Catcher by Christine Baldwin. And she uses it to help us reflect on and think through our personal stories. In the very beginning of her book, she tells a story about growing up summertime in Montana with her grandfather, who, in addition to being a rancher, was a beekeeper. And her family kept bees. And in the summer when she was there, they'd go out and bring in the honey. And honey is a very important metaphor for her family. But I want to read you this little bit. She begins, "One evening my grandfather called me into a study with a small glass bottle of honey in his hand. Under the glow of his desk lamp, he spread open the huge old Bible that had been his father's before him. The scent of honey rose from his skin, from his clothing, and maybe even from the Bible itself. 'Looky here, Chrissy,' he said, holding the cap jar like a magnifying glass over the words. 'Our bees make pure honey. You can read right through it.' The letters were slightly wiggled, but I could see them. Isaiah, he said, that's a good book. Here, read me this. His hands were square and a fleshy palm, the fingers all sinew and knuckled. Outdoor hands, calloused hands, his fingernail cleaned with a pocket knife at the horse trough where the men sluiced off dirt of the day before coming in to dinner, pointed to the middle of the page. I stood on tiptoe, balancing myself with my hands at the edge of the roll-top desk. Isaiah 55:12, I said, just like they began in the big church. For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace, and the mountains and hills before you shall break forth unto singing, and all the fields shall clap their hands. Good, he said. And where he touched my hair, I thought it smelled of honey. And where he touched my heart, there is honey still. There is honey still. So I ask you, who put honey on your heart? And I want you to take a moment, if you have a piece of paper, to write down that person. Okay? Who put honey on your heart? And what were some of their attributes? Now, I think this is a question that leads us to our image of God, just like Philomena does for the family. If we've known what it means to be loved, and the attributes of someone that can put honey on our heart can connect us with our image of the divine. Well, I used this question at a retreat on blessing, and at the break, this woman came up to me and said, "Smell this." I did, and not knowing what I should smell, and she said, "It's honey." And I'm going to pass around Burt's Bees hand lotion. And she said, "Don't you smell it? It's honey." And I said, "Yeah, you're right." She said, "My daughter gave this to me because she knows my hands are always rough and I don't carry hand lotion. So she wanted me to have this and put it on. But she said, every time I put it on, I think of her." And she's the one today I thought of who put honey on my heart. Well, we ended up using that bee balm in a ritual of blessing our hands. And it was very, very moving to make those connections. And again, I think that gives us a clue into our image of God. Now, if we had the time, and this is a retreat, it would be great to turn to your friend and share some of what you experienced. We don't have time for that today. But I invite you to consider that question as a reflection. Who puts honey on your heart? And how, in some way, does that impact, that experience, give you an image of God? In the first two chapters of the book, Kathleen Fisher offers 12 images of the divine, images or metaphors for God. And they're ones most of us are familiar with. She talks about God as the world, the body of the world. She talks about God and our creation as the image of God. And we are made in the image of God. She talks about breath and the breath of God. Now, it's interesting, in Christian scriptures, we think a lot about that, but in Eastern scriptures, there's a lot of similarity to the energy that comes in with chi and prana, to the divine source. God as spirit. This is an interesting one, and I don't know if she will take it too far, but water. God is water, and the divine spring that is within us. God is love, and that's certainly one we're taught about in our tradition. God is light. God is mercy, and that's an attribute. And so when we think about honey on the heart and characteristics of people, those attributes can help us understand our image of God. God as mystery, I'm really comfortable with that one. God as the poet of the world. God as wisdom and Sophia. And I really commend, and I know there has been study of wisdom and the wisdom literature in this class, but I think it bears a repeat look because so much of the wisdom literature was trying to bring together new understandings, which we would almost call scientific understanding, to spiritual understanding. I was rereading some of the wisdom texts this week, and I didn't go down that road, but it's an interesting one to go down, because here we are 2,000 plus years later, and the Book of Wisdom was one of the last books written, and here we are still struggling with science and spirit, and that seemed to be a struggle in the Jewish community as well. So one of the things to look into is how do her images, those ones that I just read you, those 12 images, square with your image of God? Does that work for you? Is that something important in your life and in your experience? How have those things informed your image of God? So if we take our experience, our lived experience, and put that up against or with an experience of the tradition, where does that get us? Well, I think it gets Kathleen Fisher to a very interesting place. And I don't know how many of you have spent time with her further reading and notes at the end. Has anybody taken a look at that? Because on page 139, and I really commend this section of the book to you, notes and further reading, she does more than just offer you articles and books. She gives some definitional and experiential information that's good. But I want to commend you to the last paragraph on page 139 that talks about her approach. And I think this is an undercurrent in the book, very important. The approach I take to both to affirming both the transcendence and immanence of God is called panentheism. Are most of you familiar with that term? Okay. And not of you to be confused with pantheism. Okay, and I think she studied Whitehead, she's studied Teilhard de Chardin, and they certainly come out in this panentheism point of view. The roots of this Greek word include pan, which means everything, and en, which means in, and then theos, or God. Panentheism holds that God is in everything, and everything is in God. Some people think that's a very radical point of view, but that God is more than everything. So God is transcendent, God is immanent, is in all and with all and through all. In panentheism, a Greek term that lacks the N, the universe and God are identified. Okay? So panentheism. So I think you need to look at these things at the back because I think they're critical. So if we explore and expand our image of God, we may be able to image the soul. And if the soul is, does it live on? Well, many scientists, and you read in the book, are grappling with this issue as well. And they come at it in a very interesting way. Kathleen describes the biologist Lewis Thomas. Have any of you read his book, The Life of the Cell, or any of his articles? Quite a profound writer. And his assertion is that there is a continual music in creation. There are sounds we cannot hear because our hearing isn't good enough to hear them. I heard something yesterday that birds now have vision that sees the magnetic field directionally as a pointer. So, I mean, we're just at the edge of so much. And if you can see the magnetic field, you know, what else are birds experiencing? Anyway, the harmonies of creation were also understood by the Renaissance thinkers. there's a lot of understanding of the music of the spheres coming from planetary rotations. And certainly the Greeks and Teilhard talk a lot about that. Quantum physics asserts that matter is energy, and energy seeks order in chaos. Energy seeks order. The mathematical physicist and Anglican priest, John Polkinghorne, who she cites in the book, goes on to describe the soul as not something separate from the body, but as a very complex pattern or configuration that carries information, making the body unique. Now, some of this stuff, it's really beyond my tactile limitations in life, but I'm fascinated. Kathleen writes that Polkinghorne, and I quote, insists it is reasonable to hope that the pattern that is me will be remembered by God and recreated in a new environment of God's making. So we're energy, we're a pattern of energy, we're harmonics, we're sound, and that what leads us, the soul, is really all of that in the mind and memory of God. Well, this is pretty heady stuff. And although I do think Polkinghorne, and I've read his articles, brings it down to an area or a level we can understand as non-scientific people, many of us, but does that inform your sense of what the soul is? Are we a vibration that goes on? Well, I wanted to read from an Eastern tradition, a yogic tradition, about what the soul may be. When God became himself in his own ecstasy, he danced. And when he danced, he created music out of his own ecstasy and love. And that music created the earth and the heavens and the planets and life. He was so much in ecstasy that a part of him scattered, and that is called soul. And every soul wants to return to God. So what an interesting understanding of the soul. We're that piece of God that spun out in an ecstatic moment, and we want to get back to that. Well, some of us draw our sense of what the soul is by learning about the near-death experience of people. And I imagine there are many of you in this room that have had those experiences and or know someone who has. And that certainly happened more often than not in my experience at the hospital when people went through a critical event. One day I was asked to see a gentleman who was awaiting a heart transplant. And the staff said, you know, he's kind of an old curmudgeon, but it would be good for you to see him. I don't know, good for whom. But I went into the room and introduced myself, and he promptly let me know he was an agnostic. But, you know, he was happy to have a little chat. The next day, while I was in the CCU, he had a cardiac arrest. And I stood outside the room as they sought to resuscitate him and waited for the family. And he survived. He was on the list awaiting a donor heart down at UCLA, but we had kept him at Cottage. And 2 days later, he asked to see me. And I didn't know what to expect, but I went, and he said, I need to talk to you about something that happened to me. He said, I came back. And I said, I know. I was outside the room, and the doctors worked very hard. And he said, well, and Jesus was in the room. I said, really? He said, yeah, over in that corner. He stood in that corner. And I said, well, what did he say? He said, he didn't say anything. He just looked at me. And he looked at me the whole time everything was going on. And when he looked at me, I just knew everything was going to be okay. He said, so I'm not afraid of anything. I'm not afraid of getting a heart. I'm not afraid of not getting a heart. I'm not afraid of having a cardiac arrest again. Now, Jesus would not have been the figure I would have thought might have been in the corner of the room for him. And whether my previous visit influenced that, I don't know. But he didn't see a woman, and he saw Jesus. And at that point, his story was so beautiful. I'm bold to probe, but I didn't need a description. Because whatever Jesus looked like, it was Jesus. It was his image of the divine. Several days later, we found out that there was a donor heart. We got him ready to go to UCLA. And he said, you know, on the way down, I want the ambulance to go down my street. Can we just go off the freeway and go down the street? Because I want to wave at all my neighbors. Whatever comes. Now, I don't know what happened to him. But I do know that his sense of soul and his image of God were deeply experienced by that event. And I think we can explore with people who have had these kinds of experience. What is that? What was that like for you? There's a lot of literature on it now. There's also a lot of science about it, looking into the function of the brain and lack of oxygen to the brain. So how do we put those together as well? Well, in regard to these questions, I think it's important to also think about them, not only, which I'm challenging you to do today in light of your own life and experience, but what happens to these questions when we look at the death of children or the suffering of children? Where do we apply ourselves when this happens with infants or even perinatal loss, which is very, very prominent? What happens to our image of God and our sense of the soul and what happens when there's a sudden childhood death? We've had so many here in Santa Barbara recently. Young adults, the whole gang issue, when they're violent, tragic, or they're prolonged with suffering. And we saw that at Cottage because we have a pediatric intensive care as well as a high-risk pregnancy program. How does that square? And what happens to those children when they die? And we explore this quite a bit in the bereavement program, especially around perinatal and infant loss. What happens when children die? Well, I was thinking about that question this last week when I dropped into Pete's for coffee. I think they have the best latte in town. But I'm not. I don't work for Pete. But I went there for my latte, and this woman behind me says, "Susan, do you remember me?" And I turned and I said, "Do I remember you? Of course." And she said, "You know, it's been 5 years to the day since you were with me when our daughter died, our baby died." And I said, "Well, I do, yeah, I did remember. It was very vivid for me. And we've seen each other in the community since." She and her husband had gone on to have a little boy the next year, and he was right there. He's 4 years old, full of life. She says, "He's my man, my little man." She's gone on to look at how she can be a resource for other women and families going through this kind of loss. But I felt bold to ask her, in light of this class and the questions and her openness, to ask her about her images of God and where she thought her daughter had gone. And she's a person of deep faith, so that certainly informs her image of God or her sense of the soul. But she said, "You know, I've wrestled with it. And I have finally found peace in that I see her as a hovering little angel with wings." And I was bold to say, "Do you think you'll be reunited?" And she goes, "Oh yes, we'll be reunited, but I don't know what that'll be like." And it made me think of this sense of our energy and going to be with someone we recognize, but in God's realm, not in our understanding of that. And I said, "How, you've talked about this with your son?" And she goes, "Oh yes, this daughter is with me every day. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about her." She says, "I'm crying now, but it's a good cry." I said, "I know it's a good cry." And she said, "Every anniversary of that child's death, she has either seen someone who was there or had some experience related to the day of the death. In 5 years, every year." So what is her image of God, and what is her image of the soul, and where do we go when we die? I mean, that experience, informed by faith, informed by tradition, but also coming from her wrestling, her sense of loss and grief and suffering, especially when it comes to those issues with a child. Well, do not our images of God and the nature of the soul as we understand it shape our nature, our vision of the afterlife? I think so. I think that's a place that Kathleen Fisher invites us to have that conversation. Well, Ganga White, I don't know if that name is familiar to you, but she's well known in yoga circles here in Santa Barbara. She's co-founder of White Lotus Foundation, which is up here in the foothills. And she recently published an article in Yoga Journal around life after death and meditating on life after death. And I didn't make copies for everyone, but if it's of interest, I can get one to Alice, because she has a progressive meditation. It's really worthy of your 10 or 15 minutes to do. Well, she begins the article by sharing her experience in India of going to the Burning Ghats, and then moves into more of an Eastern perspective. And that opened up memories for me that were very powerful. 2 years ago, my daughter and I spent a month in India, and I had really wanted to go to Varanasi, or Varanas, as it's sometimes referred to, on the Ganges. It is, for Hindus, the primary holy site. To die there, to be cremated there, and to have your ashes on the Ganga, as it's called, the Ganges, is a very, very holy blessing. In addition to that, I knew that 20 minutes outside of Varanasi is Deer Park, which is where the Buddha preached his first sermon after enlightenment. In India, you can't turn sideways without coming into conversation with a plethora of spiritual traditions. So the opportunity to be in that very interesting confluence of Buddhism and Sikhism and Islam and certainly Hinduism, it was very exciting to me. So we got into our hotel and we realized our hotel was at the end of the Ghats. There are a series of temples that swing around the Ganges there. And we were at the far end, so we began just to take a walk. And we realized that, you know, it was temple after temple, and these are ancient buildings. And then we came upon the Ghats. And my daughter kept saying, "Are you okay, Mom?" I think she forgot I was a hospital chaplain, but so I'm doing okay. Because it was very powerful. There's a wood pyre set up. I don't imagine that's changed much in thousands of years. The body is ceremonially washed and prepared, and then wrapped in kind of a foil shroud that's very colorful. Not dark, it's just full of color, and it's crinkly. As a matter of fact, you see them all the time in the street. People bear the bodies of their loved one to the burning ghats. We even saw one time on the little jitney things, someone had tied the body on top. And, you know, the family was walking all ahead, and you know these processions are coming because they're accompanied by very joyful music, played with flute and drum, and you hear this through the town all the day. So you're never far from death in India. You're never far from the preparation of a body. Even in the marketplace, they have these shroud stands. So, you know, I almost bought one. I thought it was quite an interesting artifact. So we watched, and there's a lot of ritual involved. The body is brought, placed on the pyre, the priest says prayers and lights the pyre. And then the oldest son or the oldest male relative attends to the fire and is there through the burning. And then the bone and ash is taken to the river, and there are prayers and blessings said. The families remain. And it is quite something to see. One evening we had dinner in a small hotel and we were looking down on the water, and I just couldn't believe. It just goes on 24 hours a day. So life and death are a part of everyday life. It's not just going to a service. it's actually following through with every critical part of death. So it's right beside you all the time, in the streets, and you can't help but think about it. So then how did that change or shape our image of the soul? How does that change and affect our image of God? Well, it's time for a break. And I, after the break, just have two more things I want to lift up. And I know we want to have time for questions. So thank you. And